All right, let's unpack this chemistry deep dive. Acids and bases.
Yeah, acids and bases. A pretty meaty chapter you've given me.
It seems like you want to get a good grasp on how organic reactions really work.
Definitely. It all seems like it's a magic show until you really break down the steps, the mechanisms.
Yep, poof, new molecules appear. And the chapter even kicks off with this cool comparison to a magic show.
Like, oh, how did they do that?
I like that. And it even mentions how nylon, for example, was discovered through this, this kind of seemingly magical process.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about a game changer. But like any good magic trick, the real fun is in figuring out like how it's done.
Right, exactly. And that's where those reaction mechanisms come in. They give us that behind the scenes view of what's happening at the molecular level.
Yeah, that electron dance.
Exactly, the electron dance, exactly.
Because think about it, there are literally millions of organic compounds and reactions out there.
Yeah.
If we tried to memorize each one individually, we'd be like totally lost.
We'd be in trouble, yeah.
It'd be like trying to learn a new language by memorizing the entire dictionary.
Yeah, like trying to memorize a dictionary. It's impossible.
No way.
No, reaction mechanisms give us the grammar, if you will. They give us the
Wow.
patterns. So instead of memorizing every single word, we can kind of learn the underlying principles and then we can apply those.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
So let's jump into one of those fundamental sets of rules, the Brunstad-Lowry definition of acids and bases.
Yeah.
Remind me what those are all about again.
Okay, so Brunstad-Lowry theory really focuses on proton transfer. So an acid is a substance that donates a proton, and a base is a substance that accepts a proton. So you can kind of picture it like a game of hot potato, but with a proton instead.
Okay.
So the acid is eager to get rid of that proton, and the base is there to catch it.
Okay, I remember this. So like in that classic example from the text, when hydrogen chloride or HCl reacts with water, HCl is the acid,
Right,
right?
exactly.
It's passing that proton off to the water molecule, which is acting as the base.
Yes, so they form the hydronium ion, which is the H3O plus wood, and the chloride ion, which is Cl minus.
Okay.
So the chloride ion would be considered the conjugate base because it's what's left of the acid after it donates that proton.
Right.
And the hydronium ion would be the conjugate acid. It's what's formed after the base accepts a proton.
All right, so those conjugate pairs are linked by that proton handoff. Okay, this is all coming back to me now.
Yeah.
But what about strong versus weak acids? I know it has to do with how easily they give up that proton, but can you kind of elaborate on that?
Yeah, so a strong acid is like someone who's desperate to get rid of that hot potato, right? So it ionizes completely in water, meaning like every single HCl molecule donates its proton. A weak acid, on the other hand, is a little bit more hesitant. It only partially ionizes, so only a fraction of the molecules actually donate their protons.
Okay, that helps. So it's not about how concentrated the acid is, but how willing it is to let go of that proton.
Right.
Now, the chapter also mentions this leveling effect of water, and I'm curious about that.
Ah, the leveling
Like,
effect.
what does that mean exactly?
So the leveling effect, it means that essentially water sets the limits for how strong an acid or base can be in aqueous solution. So any acid that's stronger than a hydronium ion will just essentially donate its proton to water, and it'll just form more hydronium ions.
Interesting.
So in water, all those super strong acids end up kind of behaving similarly.
So it's like everyone's trying to pass the hot potato to the same person in a really crowded room, you know?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And eventually that one person's holding it, no matter who started with it.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And the same applies to bases. So any base that's stronger than hydroxide will just grab a proton from water, creating more hydroxide.
So water is like the great equalizer in a way.
Exactly. It sets the playing field. Now, are you ready to move on to something that may look a little intimidating at first, but is actually incredibly helpful? Curved arrows.
Oh yes, I remember these from resonance structures, but the chapter says they're also the key to understanding these reaction mechanisms. So bring on the curved arrows.
All right. Curved arrows are how we visualize the movement of electrons during a reaction. They're like those little breadcrumbs in a fairy tale showing us exactly which path the electrons are taking.
I like that. And I remember there are a few rules to keep in mind when using these.
Definitely. So the first rule is that the arrow always starts at the source of the electrons.
Okay.
So that could be a lone pair, it could be a bond, and it points to where those electrons are going, which is the atom that will be accepting them.
So we're not moving atoms around with these arrows. We're just showing where the electrons are headed.
Exactly.
What else?
So the second rule is that electrons always flow from an area of high electron density to an area of low electron density. Think of it like a ball rolling downhill. It naturally wants to go from higher potential energy to lower potential energy.
Got it. And I think, if I remember correctly, we have to make sure that our electron movements don't create any illegal situations. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't want to break that octet rule, right?
Exactly. The third rule is make sure that no second row elements end up with more than 8 valence electrons. You know, they're very strict about that octet rule.
They are.
Yeah. And the fourth and final rule is to only use a single barbed arrow for the movement of one electron.
Okay. And I remember from previous chapters that this usually only applies to reactions involving radicals.
Exactly.
Okay, 4 rules. Got it. So let's actually apply these rules to a reaction. What about that HCl and water reaction we were talking about earlier? Like, how do we use curved arrows to show what's happening there?
Okay, great example. So as the water molecule approaches the HCl, one of the lone pairs of electrons on the oxygen atom of water will form a new bond with the proton of the HCl. And we show that with a curved arrow. It starts from the lone pair on oxygen and points directly at the hydrogen atom of the HCl molecule.
Okay, I can picture that. And what about the bond between the hydrogen and the chlorine in the HCl? It has to break, right?
Right. As that new bond forms, the bond between the hydrogen and chlorine breaks, and the electrons in that bond move on to the chlorine atom. We show that with another curved arrow. This one starts from the bond between the hydrogen and chlorine and points towards the chlorine.
So one arrow is showing the formation of the new bond, and the other arrow is showing the breaking of the old bond. That's pretty neat.
It is. And this two-arrow process is really, really common in acid-base reactions.
Now, I'm curious to try it with a different reaction. Can we walk through another example using those curved arrows? Maybe with a different acid and base.
Sure, yeah. The chapter actually has several practice problems that all kind of follow the same basic pattern. So it's like learning a new dance move, you know? Once you get those steps down, then you can kind of apply those steps to different songs. So how about we try one with methanol, CH3OH, and hydrobromic acid, HBr.
Okay, methanol and HBr. Let me see if I can get this. So methanol has an oxygen with those lone pairs, so that's going to make it the base, right?
Right. Yeah.
And HBr is the acid ready to give up that proton.
Yep, exactly. It's exactly like that HCl and water reaction. So a lone pair on the oxygen of methanol will attack the proton of HBr, and at the same time, the bond between the hydrogen and the bromine will break, giving those electrons to the bromine.
And we can show all that with our trusty curved arrows, right?
Yes.
So starting from the lone pair on oxygen, pointing to that proton on HBr, and then another arrow from that HBr bond going towards the bromine.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I think I'm getting the hang of this.
You're getting it. You're becoming quite the electron choreographer.
Uh-huh. I'll take it.
And, you know, this pattern of a lone pair attacking a proton, it's really, really common in organic chemistry. Mm. In fact, molecules that donate their lone pairs to form bonds with protons, those are our bases, but they also tend to be good nucleophiles.
Okay, nucleophiles, yeah. Right? Those nucleus-loving species we talked about before, attracted to those positive charges. And I guess a proton is about as positive as it gets, right?
Exactly. And on the flip side, we have electrophiles. They're the electron-seeking species. Those are like our acids, the ones that are accepting those electron pairs.
Okay, so it seems like there's a connection between Brunsted-Lowry acids and bases, and these electrophiles and nucleophiles.
Right, there is. That's a great segue into our next topic, which is Lewis acids and bases.
Okay.
So this theory kind of expands our understanding of acids and bases beyond just proton transfer.
All right, I'm intrigued. So how does the Lewis definition differ from Brunsted-Lowry?
Okay, so instead of focusing on protons, Lewis theory looks at electron pairs. So a Lewis acid is an electron pair acceptor, and a Lewis base is an electron pair donor.
So it's still all about those electron pairs, but we're broadening our view a little bit beyond just proton transfer.
Right, precisely. So a great example is the reaction between aluminum chloride, LCl3, and ammonia, NH3. So aluminum chloride doesn't have a proton to donate, but it's still considered an acid because it can accept an electron pair from ammonia.
Oh, okay. I bet we can visualize this with our curved arrows, right?
Yes, we can.
So the lone pair on the nitrogen of ammonia is going to attack the aluminum in the aluminum chloride.
Exactly.
Okay.
That lone pair on nitrogen will form a new bond with the aluminum, giving it a full octet.
Ah, so aluminum's happy now with its full octet. But what about nitrogen? It's sharing an electron pair that it used to have all to itself.
That's a good observation. So nitrogen actually ends up with a formal positive charge. And this also highlights something interesting about Lewis acids. They can accept electron pairs without breaking any bonds, unlike Brønsted-Lowry acids, where that proton has to kind of let go of its bond in order to move.
That's right. Because Lewis acids, like that aluminum chloride, are often electron deficient to begin with.
Right.
So they're missing electrons in their outer shell, and they really want to accept a pair to fill that void.
You got it. Now, do you see how this Lewis acid-based concept connects back to those electrophiles and nucleophiles we were talking about?
Let me think. So Lewis acids, like electrophiles, are seeking those electrons. And Lewis bases, like nucleophiles, are looking to donate their electrons.
Exactly. Lewis acid-based theory gives us like this broader framework for understanding those electrophile-nucleophile interactions that are so important in organic chemistry.
Okay, that makes sense. So Lewis acid-based theory kind of helps us zoom out to see the bigger picture.
Exactly, exactly.
All right, so even though all Lewis acids and bases can be considered electrophiles and nucleophiles, we typically use those terms, electrophile and nucleophile, specifically when we're talking about reactions that involve carbon.
That's a good point. It's all about context.
Okay.
Now, speaking of carbon, let's talk about two really, really important species in organochemistry, carbocations and carbanions.
Okay, carbocations and carbanions. I remember those terms, but I need a little refresher. They're both carbon species, but one has a positive charge and one has a negative charge, right?
Exactly. So carbocations are positively charged carbon atoms, meaning they're missing an electron. So they only have 6 valence electrons. And this makes them incredibly reactive. They are desperate to find electrons to complete their octet.
So they're like the hungry hippos of the molecular world.
I love that analogy.
Okay.
Now, carbanions are the opposite. They have a negative charge, meaning they have an extra electron pair. So they're electron rich and they're ready to share that wealth.
Okay. So if carbocations are the hungry hippos, then carbanions are like those generous philanthropists, you know.
Great, I love it.
Eager to donate their electron fortune.
Exactly. And this difference in electron density really is what drives their reactivity.
Okay.
So carbocations are powerful electrophiles, those Lewis acids always searching for those electrons. And carbanions are strong nucleophiles, those Lewis bases, ready to donate that electron pair.
This is reminding me of what we were just discussing, how those Lewis acids and bases fit into that bigger picture of electrophiles and nucleophiles.
Right.
So essentially, carbocations are electrophiles and carbanions are nucleophiles.
You got it. And understanding their behavior is really key to unlocking a whole world of organic reactions. So now that we've met the players, let's talk about how we measure their strength. Specifically, you know, how do we know how strong an acid is?
Oh, that's a great question. I remember terms like Ka and pK being thrown around a lot.
Uh-huh.
Can you remind me what those are all about again?
Yeah, so Ka is the acidity constant. It's a measure of how easily an acid donates a proton in solution. Mm. So a large Ka value means it's a strong acid, while a small Ka value means it's a weak acid holding onto that proton more tightly.
And pK is just the negative logarithm of Ka, right?
Uh-huh.
So the lower pK means a stronger acid.
Exactly, yep. It's just a more convenient way to express those, you know, sometimes very large or very small Ka values.
Yeah.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Knowing the pK values of different molecules is like having a cheat sheet for predicting if a reaction will happen. Remember, acid-base reactions always favor the formation of the weaker acid and the weaker base.
Right, because they want to settle into that lower energy state.
Exactly, exactly. So if we know the pK values of the reactants and the potential products, we can actually figure out which side of that reaction will be favored at equilibrium.
Oh, so it's like predicting the winner of a tug of war.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Okay. And the chapter actually gives a great example with a carboxylic acid reacting with sodium hydroxide, which is NaOH.
Okay.
So carboxylic acids have pKa values around 4 to 5, while water has a pKi of 15.7.
Okay.
So when a carboxylic acid reacts with NaOH, that proton is transferred to the hydroxide ion, forming water, which is the weaker acid, and a carboxylate ion, which is the weaker base. Equilibrium wins.
That's so cool. We can actually predict which way the reaction is going to go just by knowing those pKa values.
Yep, it's pretty neat.
All right, now let's shift gears a little bit. The chapter spends quite a bit of time talking about how the structure of a molecule can impact its acidity.
Uh-huh.
So what are some of the key factors at play here?
Yeah, so this is where we start to see the beauty of organic chemistry. So the structure of a molecule can dramatically influence its properties, including its acidity. So let's start with bond strength.
Okay.
As we go down a column in the periodic table, the bond strength between the hydrogen and the other atom decreases, which actually leads to a stronger acid.
Okay, I think I see where this is going. Huh. So for example, in the halogen group, hydriodic acid, or HI, is a stronger acid than hydrobromic acid, HBr, which is stronger than hydrochloric acid, HCl, and so on.
Exactly.
And that's because the HI bond is weaker than the HBr bond, which is weaker than the HCl bond.
Exactly, exactly. That weaker bond makes it easier for that hydrogen to kind of pop off as a proton. Now, let's mill across a row on the periodic table. As we do that, electronegativity increases, and so does acidity.
Electronegativity, right? That's the atom's ability to kind of pull those electrons towards itself.
Uh-huh.
So I'm guessing the more electronegative an atom is, the more it's going to hog those electrons in that bond, making the hydrogen feel a little bit more positive and easier to give up as a proton.
You nailed it. And the chapter actually shows this really nicely using electrostatic potential maps.
Okay.
You can actually see how the positive charge on the hydrogen atom increases as you go from methane to ammonia to water to hydrogen fluoride.
Okay.
And fluorine being the most electronegative and therefore creating the strongest acid in that series.
Those maps are pretty cool. So we've got bond strength and electronegativity playing roles in acidity.
Uh-huh.
Are there any other structural factors we need to consider?
Yeah, there are a couple more. Hybridization also plays a part. So remember that spy hybridized carbon atoms are effectively more electronegative than spy 2 hybridized carbons, which are more electronegative than spy 3 hybridized carbons.
Right, and that makes sense because the more spy character in that hybrid orbital, the closer those electrons are held to the nucleus, making that carbon atom a little bit more electronegative.
Exactly. And the chapter provides a great example of that with ethene, ethene, and ethene.
Okay.
So ethene, with its spy hybridized carbons, is the most acidic, followed by ethene, sp2, and then finally ethene, sp3.
So the more spy a character, the stronger the acid. Got it. What about inductive effects? I vaguely remember that term having something to do with electron withdrawing groups.
You're right on the money. So inductive effects are all about how electron density can be pulled through the sigma bonds of a molecule. And electron withdrawing groups, like halogens, are particularly good at this.
Oh, okay.
They pull electron density towards themselves, which can then influence the acidity of nearby hydrogen atoms.
So if you have an electron withdrawing group close to an acidic hydrogen, it's like it's making that hydrogen even more positive, encouraging it to leave as a proton.
That's a great way to think about it. And not only does it make it easier for the proton to leave, but it also helps to stabilize the negative charge that forms on the conjugate base, making the acid even stronger.
Ah, so it's like a double win for acidity.
Yep, it is. And the chapter compares acetic acid and chloroacetic acid to illustrate this.
Okay.
So chloroacetic acid is more acidic because that chlorine atom is pulling electron density away from that carboxyl group, making it easier for the proton to leave, and then also stabilizing that resulting negative charge.
Okay, I'm seeing a pattern here. Anything that stabilizes that conjugate base is going to make the acid stronger.
You're absolutely right. And this brings us to a really interesting comparison. Carboxylic acids versus alcohols.
Oh, now that you mention it, I've always wondered about that. Like, why are carboxylic acids so much more acidic than alcohols, even though they both have that OH group?
It's a great question. And the answer lies in the stability of their conjugate bases. So carboxylate ions, the conjugate bases of carboxylic acids, are much more stable than alkoxide ions, the conjugate bases of alcohols.
Okay, I'm guessing resonance plays a role here.
You bet. So we can actually draw two equivalent resonance structures for a carboxylate ion where that negative charge is shared equally between the two oxygen atoms. And this delocalization of charge makes it much more stable.
So that negative charge is like a hot potato being tossed back and forth between those two oxygen atoms.
Yeah, exactly.
Making it much easier to handle.
Yeah.
But in an alkoxide ion, that negative charge is kind of stuck on a single oxygen atom.
Right.
No resonance rescue.
Exactly. And on top of that, you have the inductive effect. So that carboxylate ion has two electronegative oxygens pulling electron density away from that negatively charged carbon, further stabilizing that charge.
Okay.
Alcohols only have one oxygen, so the inductive effect is weaker.
So it's like that carboxylate ion has a whole team helping it manage that negative charge while that alkoxide ion is going it alone. No wonder carboxylic acids are more acidic.
Great analogy.
Okay, I think I'm getting it. Now, have you ever heard of phenols?
Yes.
They're similar to alcohols, but have a unique twist that makes them more acidic.
Right.
So phenols, they're those compounds with an OH group attached directly to a benzene ring, right?
That's the one. And that benzene ring has a significant impact on its acidity.
So how does that benzene ring make phenols more acidic than regular alcohols?
Well, for starters, the carbon atom that's attached to the OH group in a phenol is septi-2 hybridized.
Oh, okay.
So making it more electronegative than that SP3 hybridized carbon in an alcohol. So that means it's pulling electron density away from the OH group, making that hydrogen a little bit more acidic.
Okay, that makes sense. But I'm feeling resonance is involved here too.
Right. You know it.
Yeah.
So we can draw resonance structures for phenol and the phenoxide ion, which is its conjugate base, showing that negative charge being delocalized over the benzene ring.
Ah, so that benzene ring is like a safety net helping to spread out that negative charge through resonance, making that phenoxide ion more stable.
Exactly. And this difference in acidity is actually quite useful in the lab. We can use it to separate phenols from alcohols.
Oh, wait, really? Tell me more about that.
Okay. So phenols are acidic enough to react with a strong base, like sodium hydroxide, NaOH, to form a water-soluble salt, which would be sodium phenoxide.
Okay.
Most alcohols, however, won't react with NaOH to any significant extent.
So if we have a mixture of a phenol and an alcohol, we can add NaOH, and the phenol is going to dissolve in that water layer of sodium phenoxide, while the alcohol will kind of stay in that organic layer. That's pretty clever.
It is. And we can even distinguish phenols from carboxylic acids using sodium bicarbonate,
okay,
which is NaHCO3. So carboxylic acids are strong enough to react with it, while phenols are not.
So it's like a whole separation scheme based on acidity.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Now, the chapter briefly mentions solvent effects, which I'm a little fuzzy on.
Uh-huh.
How does the solvent play a role in all of this?
Ah, that's a great question. So solvents can have a big impact on how easily an acid gives up its proton. For example, most acids are actually weaker in the gas phase than in solution.
Oh, really? Why is that?
Well, in the gas phase, when an acid loses a proton, those oppositely charged ions are difficult to separate. It's like trying to pull apart two magnets. It takes a lot of energy.
But in a solution, the solvent molecules can surround and stabilize those ions,
right,
making it easier to kind of keep them apart.
Exactly. And protonic solvents like water or alcohols are particularly good at stabilizing ions because they can form hydrogen bonds with them.
Right. Those hydrogen bonds are like little bridges between the positive and negative charges, helping to keep them happy and separated.
Mm-hmm.
So protonic solvents are those that have a hydrogen atom attached to a strongly electronegative atom, like oxygen or nitrogen.
Right. You got it. Yep. So water, alcohols, even ammonia are all examples of protonic solvents.
Okay. Now, we've spent a lot of time talking about acids, but what about organic compounds acting as bases?
Okay.
I know we touched on amines, which are those nitrogen-containing compounds, classic bases.
Right.
But can other organic compounds act as bases too? What about those oxygen-containing compounds?
You're thinking along the right lines. So any organic compound that has an atom with a lone pair of electrons can potentially act as a base. So alcohols, ethers, even compounds with carbonyl groups can all accept a proton from a strong acid.
So even though they're not as well known for their basicity as in amines, they can still step up and accept that proton when needed.
Exactly.
Right.
And the chapter shows methanol, diethyl ether, and even acetone reacting with strong acids as examples. And these proton transfer reactions are often the first step in many other reactions that that these compounds can undergo.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's like the acid is kind of activating that molecule, making it more more ready to react in a way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I remember from earlier that the pi bond in an alkene can also act as a base.
You have a great memory. Even though alkenes don't have that lone pair of electrons, you know, like alcohols or ethers, those electrons in that pi bond are still available to grab a proton from a strong acid.
So it's like the alkene is using its pi bond as a temporary lone pair.
That's a great way to visualize it. And this highlights how you know, how diverse organic compounds can be in terms of their reactivity. They have all these different tools at their disposal for interacting with other molecules. Now, ready to see all these concepts kind of come together in a real reaction mechanism.
Absolutely. I'm ready to see those curved arrows in action.
Okay. Well, the chapter uses the reaction of tert-butyl alcohol with hydrochloric acid to form tert-butyl chloride as an example. And it's a perfect illustration of how acid-base reactions can be involved in those individual steps of a larger organic transformation.
All right, let's break this mechanism down step by step. What happens first?
Okay, so the first step is a classic Brinsted-Lowry acid-base reaction.
Okay.
So the oxygen atom of that tert-butyl alcohol is going to act as a base, accepting a proton from the hydronium ion, which is, you know, a strong acid that forms when that HCl reacts with water.
All right, so we show this with a curved arrow starting from the lone pair on the oxygen of tert-butyl alcohol and pointing to that, to the hydrogen atom of that hydronium ion.
Exactly. And another curved arrow will show the bond between the hydrogen and oxygen in the hydronium ion breaking, with the electrons moving on to the oxygen atom, which then forms water molecule.
Okay, so now that tert-butyl alcohol has a positive charge on that oxygen atom, doesn't that make it a good leaving group?
You're right. So in the second step, the carbon-oxygen bond breaks and the electrons in that bond move on to the oxygen atom, which departs as a water molecule. And this leaves behind a tert-butyl carbocation.
So another curved arrow, this time starting from the bond between the carbon and the oxygen and pointing toward that oxygen atom.
Yeah.
And now we've created that carbocation, which we know is super reactive.
Exactly. Remember those hungry hippos?
Uh-huh, yes.
Well, here's a carbocation ready to gobble up some electrons.
Yeah.
And in the final step, the chloride ion, which was, you know, kind of hanging out from that first step, will act as a nucleophile, attacking that carbocation and forming a new carbon-chlorine bond.
Right. Last curved arrow from a lone pair on that chloride ion to the positively charged carbon atom of the carbocation. And just like that, we formed tert-butyl chloride.
You got it. Yeah. That's our three-step mechanism. And it shows how acid-base reactions can actually drive organic reactions forward.
It's like a chain reaction, yeah, with each step setting up the next one.
It is. It's really quite elegant. And it highlights how understanding those basic principles like acid-base reactions and electron flow can really unlock the secrets of these more complex transformations.
It's amazing how much we can predict and explain just by understanding those fundamental concepts.
Right.
Now, the chapter also talks about reactions in non-aqueous solutions, which seems a bit counterintuitive. Why would we want to use a solvent other than water, especially since water is often considered the universal solvent?
That's a great question. You see, water is a great solvent for many things, but it does have its limitations. Remember that leveling effect we talked about earlier? Right. So water kind of puts a limit on how strong a base we can use, because any base that's stronger than a hydroxide ion will just grab a proton from water.
So it's like water sets a ceiling on base strength.
Exactly. But what if we need a really strong base for a particular reaction? That's where non-aqueous solvents come in.
Ah, I see. So we can use a solvent that's less acidic than water, which allows us to access a wider range of bases. What are some examples of these non-aqueous solvents?
Well, we can use solvents like hexane, diethyl ether, or even liquid ammonia.
Okay.
So they won't donate protons as easily as water. So stronger bases can be used without being immediately neutralized.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And the chapter gives the example of converting ethine to its conjugate base using sodium amide, or NaNH2,
yeah,
and liquid ammonia. So sodium amide is a very strong base, and it would just react with the water.
Exactly. But in liquid ammonia, it's free to deprotonate that ethane, forming a really useful species called the ethanide ion.
So by switching to a non-aqueous solvent, we unlock a whole new world of reactivity.
That's pretty cool. What other advantages are there to using non-aqueous solvents?
Well, another advantage, especially when using alcohols as solvents, is that we can use alkoxide ions as bases.
Alkoxide ions, those are the conjugate bases of alcohols, right?
You got it.
Like methoxide or ethoxide.
Yep. And alkoxide ions are stronger bases than hydroxide ions. Because remember, alcohols are weaker acids than water.
Ah, right. The weaker the acid, the stronger its conjugate base.
Exactly.
That inverse relationship is so important. So how do we actually make these alkoxide solutions?
We can generate them by reacting an alcohol with a very strong base, like sodium hydride.
Okay. So if we add sodium hydride to, say, ethanol, it'll essentially, like, rip off that acidic proton from the ethanol.
forming hydrogen gas and leaving behind that ethoxide ion, which can then act as a base.
You nailed it. And we can do the same thing with other alcohols to create different alkoxide bases.
It's like we're expanding our toolbox of bases with each new solvent we explore.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, the chapter also mentions these really powerful bases called alkalithium compounds, like methylithium or butyllithium. Yeah. What's the deal with those?
Alkalithium compounds are incredibly reactive. They're so strong that they actually act as though they contain alkanide ions.
Oh, wow.
Which are the conjugate bases of alkanes.
And since alkanes are like notoriously unreactive and weak acids, their conjugate bases must be insanely strong.
You got it. They're like the superheroes of the base world.
Wow.
So for example, butyllithium can easily deprotonate a terminal alkyne, like ethene.
Wow, that's impressive. Yeah. So we've got this whole spectrum of bases to work with.
Right.
From those relatively mild ones, like water, to these super strong alkalithium compounds. It's amazing how much variety there is in the world of bases.
It is. And the choice of which base to use really depends entirely on the specific reaction that we're trying to do. Sometimes we need a gentle nudge and sometimes we need a powerful push. It's all about choosing the right tool for the job.
Now I have to ask, what's the point of having all these different bases? Like what are some cool things we can actually do with them?
Well, besides their obvious use in deprotonating acidic compounds, strong bases can be used for a whole bunch of interesting applications. For instance, we can use them to introduce deuterium or tritium labels into molecules.
Oh, deuterium and tritium labels. Those are isotopes of hydrogen, right? Yes, that's right. Deuterium has one proton and one neutron, and tritium has one proton and two neutrons.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like heavier versions of regular hydrogen. But why would we want to stick them onto molecules?
Well, because they're isotopes, we can actually use them as labels to track specific atoms in a molecule during a reaction. It's like putting a tiny little GPS tracker on an atom and seeing where it goes.
Oh, that's clever. So how do we use acid-base reactions to introduce these labels?
Okay, let's say we have a molecule with an acidic hydrogen, like a terminal alkyne. So we can react that with a strong base in a non-aqueous solvent, like sodium amide in liquid ammonia. And this will generate a carbanion, remember, that carbon with the extra lone pair and the negative charge.
Right. And then what? Do we just like throw some deuterium or tritium at it?
Not quite. We use something called heavy water, which is D2O or T2O, where those regular hydrogens are replaced with deuterium or tritium. So when we add the heavy water to our reaction, that carbanion will grab a deuterium or a tritium ion from it.
So it's like a simple proton transfer, but instead of a regular proton, it's picking up a deuterium or tritium ion.
Exactly. And this technique is incredibly valuable in organic chemistry and biochemistry. We can use these labeled molecules to study reaction mechanisms and figure out exactly how molecules are transformed during a reaction.
Wow, that's incredible. It's like we're able to watch these molecular dances unfold in real time.
It really is remarkable. And it all comes back to those fundamental concepts we've been talking about, acid-base reactions, electron flow, the influence of structure and solvent.
This has been such an eye-opening deep dive. It's amazing how something as seemingly simple as the transfer of a proton can have such profound implications for how molecules behave and react.
It really highlights the beauty and the elegance of chemistry, doesn't it? Those simple rules can lead to such incredible complexity and diversity in the molecular world.
Absolutely. I feel like I have a much deeper appreciation for the intricacies of acid-base chemistry now. It's not just about memorizing definitions and formulas. It's about understanding those fundamental principles that govern how molecules interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And those principles are universal. While we focused on organic molecules today, these same concepts apply to, you know, all areas of chemistry and even beyond. Think about the pH of your blood or the reactions happening inside every cell in your body. Acid-base chemistry is everywhere.
That's such a good point. It's amazing to think how these concepts we've explored today are playing out all around us in the world and even within our own bodies.
So you've got the tools now. You can start to predict how molecules might react based on their structure, their properties, and even the environment they're in.
I'm definitely going to be looking at molecules in a whole new light now.
That's what we like to hear. You know, this deep dive has only scratched the surface. There's a whole universe of fascinating chemistry out there waiting to be explored.
I can't wait to keep learning and keep asking questions. Thanks for guiding me through this incredible journey into the world of acids and bases.
It was my pleasure. Happy exploring.